Happy New Year, people. Hi, it's me, your favorite podcaster, Bonnie Somerville from Second Act. I was gone for a while, but I'm back. I hope you all had a great holiday. It's an amazing time. We have a new year. We have a new president. Hopefully we're going to get out of this freaking pandemic soon because it's been hell on all of us. Had to take a little break. I was shooting Blue Bloods in New York City for a few weeks, and which was great. And then went away for a while, had some family stuff. Lots of things went on. But most importantly, I got engaged. Ta-da! And they said it wouldn't happen. But officially, I am in my second act, and I am engaged to Mr. Dave McLean, who is my producer, and he's listening to this right now. And I would not be doing this podcast without him, because honestly, guys, he does all the work. He does all the graphics. He does all the editing. And speaking of graphics, our Instagram page was deleted by those fuckers. I'm just kidding. But I don't know what happened. It just went away. It deleted, and they didn't get back to me, and I tried. So all of that hard work that Dave did was wiped out. But not to worry, because I know that you've been really upset about it, looking forward every single day. We have a new one. It is second_act_podcast on Instagram. So I'm going to start to put up all the same photos and new photos, and please message me there. I would love to hear from all of you. And also, you know, you can always find me on Bonz with a Z, Somerville, on Instagram, because I'm cool, like the Fonz. God, I'm so cheesy. But yes, I am engaged, and that is an amazing second act for me. It's crazy. You never know. You think you're never going to find love, and you just have so many failures, and a lot of us, you know, took the long wait, and 46 years old, I met my man, so you just never know when your second act or your third or your 400th is coming. So there's just a little cheesy inspiration for you. And I'm definitely going to have an interview with Dave. I think we should just do like a relationship interview, because so many of you message me about that. And I've certainly had a few. So we will do that. And you could get to talk to him too. And so many wonderful people coming up in the new year. This next person, I'm so excited about. We went to high school together back in Brooklyn, Bay Ridge, Poly Prep. What's up? So proud of her success. She has had so many amazing acts in her life, everything from high school English teacher at LaGuardia, you know, the famous Fame school, to working at Vogue, to working at Departures, and then now she is editor-in-chief for 9 years of Town & Country magazine, which is the oldest running magazine in America. It's 180 years old, which is pretty amazing. She also is a historical jewelry expert, which are two of my favorite things. I'm obsessed with history, if you know me and follow me. I'm a medieval history junkie. And I'm obsessed with jewelry, too. I'm kind of really a girly girl about that stuff. Her book is on Amazon. It's called Jewels That Made History, 101 Stones, Myths, and Legends. So you got to look at that book. It is stunning. Her name is Stellene Volandez. I am so proud of all she's done, and I'm honored that she came on my little podcast, and I can't wait to share this interview with you. So please enjoy. So I'm very excited to talk to somebody who actually went to my high school in Brooklyn, Poly Prep, I think what, class of 89, who is the editor of Town and Country, editor of Town and Country, and has done so many fabulous, glamorous things. And I am obsessed with her taste in all things, especially jewelry, and a fellow history lover, Stellene Volandez. Hi.
Hi, Bonnie. And I will tell everyone listening that I remember I had graduated and I came back to see Bonnie Somerville in Cabaret. No. And I remember that. I do.
You did.
I do. Aww. Because I was really involved in the theater program at Poly. And so I graduated in 89, and then I was home from college and some of the people in the theater department said, oh, you should come see this cabaret. It's really great. And Becky Feldman, who's also out in LA and doing amazing things in LA, was in it as well. She played the MC and she was a close friend. And so I came and I remember you as Sally Bowles. I do.
Thank you. That is so, I'm so flattered. I think that was my highest moment. I think I peaked. I peaked at the Richard Perry Theater.
I think there have been some other big peaks after that. But
I wanted to do that on Broadway.
Movie's not over yet. And I remember you hadn't been so involved in theater. So it was like this revelation to see Bonnie Somerville up on stage.
Thank you. That is so, I'm very flattered. Yeah, I was so, I was honored because Miss Laura Eliasoff, I will never forget her name. I still have a photo of her framed next to my bed, like just as motivation, because I auditioned and I was so nervous, and she was like, I was kind of a pain in the ass kind of teen and constantly in detention. And I wasn't like the quiet one. I'm still not the quiet one. And she was like, I'm going to give you this chance. And if you mess with me, and if you don't give me 1,000%, because like nobody thinks that you could do this. And I was a sophomore, and it was like a huge change in my life. Like talk about like my first act. That was kind of, I was like, someone believed in me and I did it you know? And it was, oh God, what an amazing. That's very.
Isn't it amazing? No, but it really is true. I really do remember it and thinking like, oh, I you know, because I knew all your group of friends because
none
you
of
all
them
dated
were in
a
theater.
Lot of guys. No, but you all dated a lot of guys in my grade. So we all sort of had it in view, to be honest.
And let's be
and
honest.
And so then suddenly,
it wasn't the most artsy high school, like everyone out there to know. We went to top 10 Ivy League prep school, an amazing school, and it's 200 something years old. And now forget it. I can't believe how much it costs. I don't know how any of our parents could afford it now. It's like ridiculous, but it was a jock school. You know, it was an academic and athletic school. So if you did art, it was not cool. None of my friends were in the art scene. Yeah. Are you still in touch with a lot of people from Poly? Because I kind of left and did my own thing and never really.
You know, I am in touch with them. I had a few close friends that I stayed in touch with. And then over this period, actually, a small group from the class of 89 has had a regular Zoom call. And we started it in maybe April, and it was weekly for a while, and now it's monthly, but we still do it. And it's, you know, it's interesting because it's not the people I was closest to in school, but it's people that that I have developed these great friendships with now. And it's been a really wonderful thing.
That's amazing.
You know, Polly, I always say, I mean, you talked about sort of the teacher who changed your life. And as we go through first acts and second acts and third acts, those people, you know, I think you learn to have your own voice that says you can do this. But having someone else say you can do it is always such an important moment. And I had a lot of those people. It justifies it. And it just feels, you know, having support, I think is, you know, I think we all work really hard to be self-sufficient and to learn to sort of lean on ourselves a lot for support. But having support, I think this time has proved to us how important it is. And how important it is to support others and to support, you know, each other.
Talk about second acts, this whole entire pandemic. And you're so involved with helping save the local places in New York and all the places you love. And yeah, I mean, I agree. If Miss Eliasoff, I swear I have her photo in my bedside table. And I just really, I was just not the kid that anyone would have taken a chance on at the time, because I was just kind of like going through, it was like a difficult kid, my parents and divorce. Like I wasn't wasn't the kid that you'd like bet on like that. And she was like, you can do this, but you have to promise me that you're going to give me 100%. You're not going to be late. You could do this. And it really did change my life completely. And now I'm like, God, I wish I had more of that now in my career, you know, because then, you know, that kind of goes away the more success we have. But speaking of success, you went from like Poly to Vassar to being a high school teacher at LaGuardia for 3 years, right?
Well, there's one. Well, it's not exactly that. So,
and you got your master's
after Poly. I did. So after Poly, I went to Vassar, thinking maybe I would go be a drama major, because I had been so involved in theater at Poly. But at Vassar, being a drama major is like a really serious thing, and you have to learn set design and costume design. And I was like, you know, maybe not. And, you know, someone said, if you can get talked out of it, you shouldn't do it. And I got talked out of it pretty quickly. And then I became an English major. And I became an English major and I interned at lots of magazines during college. I would come down from Poughkeepsie to the city and go back up at night. And so after college, I got a job at Vogue. So I was at Vogue for 3 years. I was the assistant to the arts editor and the features editor.
Oh my God.
And that's important because that features editor really became one of my mentors. So after 3 years at Vogue, I thought, you know, I'm not sure if this is what I want my life to be about. I'm not sure what's next. And I thought I want to go back to school and I think I want to be an English teacher. And so I went and got my master's and then I did. I taught for about 2.5 years at LaGuardia, the FAME school.
Yeah, for people that don't know, that is the FAME school, which I wanted to go to because I did think at the time people were leaping throughout the hallways and tap dancing. And my mom actually
Hot lunch jam.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed to go there because I got into Poly and she was like, you're going to Poly. But were kids leaping all over the place? Is that true? Or was that just the movie?
They weren't. They definitely weren't. But it is an amazing, amazing place. And that it exists in this city is remarkable. It is, I mean, the kids that I taught were, you know, I mean, so creative in every way.
And it's allowed to be.
Incredibly diverse. Yes, and allowed to be.
That's why that school is so important. Like, the only school like that in LA that I know of is Crossroads. And that's the art and science, like that the parent, I mean, you don't find high schools, especially public schools, like where you're allowed to be a writer, a painter, a designer, a singer. And like, where do you find that? That's amazing.
Remarkable place. And it also, and I loved it. And being in front of a classroom, I mean, it is maybe sort of my natural habitat. I mean, I really felt so comfortable. And, you know, I think it sort of helped me. I do a lot of public speaking now for Town and Country and for my books. And that experience, I mean, I think the other thing you learn is every single thing you do somehow helps you in the next thing that you do, even if you don't realize it or you don't expect it to, it does. Right, exactly. Something that, so like being in front of those, you know, like 35 teenagers and trying to get them to be interested in the Scarlet Letter, I mean, it shows you how to take whatever subject. I mean, it helped me so much in my writing too, because it's, you know, you think sort of, okay, maybe none of them are interested in this. What am I going to open this lesson with that's going to get them interested in it? And it's the same way when I'm starting a piece for Town and Country, I think the same way, right? What's my way in? And so after that experience.
Oh, I was just going to say, you went to Departures, but I wanted to go back about how did you go from like your Greek? I love all of your Greek like stories. You know, that's my favorite place in the world. I've only been once, but I swear to God, if I could have a little place in Greece, like It is heaven. But so you have this Greek family, you grew up in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Like, how did you go from that to going into the fashion editorial Vogue? Because that world to me is still so glamorous, because I've never, other than press for shows. And I mean, I modeled a little bit, but I wasn't a good one. I mean, it was mostly like Bloomingdale's. How did that happen? Like what, how did that lead you to that glamorous New York? Like, I just think of Devil Wears Prada every time you say Vogue.
My big factory. Oh, yeah. Big Fat Greek Wedding and The Devil Wears Prada, right? Like, how do you sort of get from a Big Fat Greek Wedding to The Devil Wears Prada? Well, I think, you know, I mean, listen, I loved My Big Fat Greek Wedding. I mean, I watch it and I cry both from laughing and from like genuine emotion. And there's, you know, I definitely grew up, and you know, in Poly, there were a lot of Greek Poly, and in our sort of Brooklyn community. And you know, for me, that meant community, it meant a sense of identity, and it meant for me also that I always had a cheering section no matter what I did. And so I think some people sort of take that and stay within it, like very tightly. I sort of somehow I felt like I could venture out of it because I always knew that I would have that support.
Wow.
You know, and if I, so, and I also, I had an uncle who was an actor. And so from when I was very young, sort of, I was introduced to a different world. And I will tell you, like, he took me to see The King and I when I was like 5 years old. And we went to the Plaza after, and that was it. I was sort of, you know, and I met all his theater friends, and I was like, okay, this is it.
Yeah.
And I think I just had, you know, and I had teachers who, you know, I had my eye on a certain way I wanted to live and the kind of people I wanted to be around. And I just sort of, or was guided by that. I'm still super in touch with my sort of Greek community and you know, Greek friends. And I go to Greece every summer and sometimes twice a year.
I know, I'm always jealous when I see your Instagram stories. My God.
This is the first time I haven't been in a year in a very long time. And it is my first pre-pandemic trip for sure. But yeah, so I sort of had a vision of being in that world. And I think, you know, I was at Vogue, I was in the features department, which, you know, I think is a different experience than being in the fashion department. And I was lucky enough to have two bosses, two editors there who were really wonderful to me. And, you know, when I left LaGuardia, one of them had become editor in chief of departures and he hired me. He hired me back. And, you know, and when I decided that teaching was not going to be sort of my long-term career, I wondered if I would be able to get back into magazines, or if I would have to be someone's assistant all over again. And he really gave me a second chance. And I stayed at that magazine for 9 years.
Wow. I remember that magazine. I used to temp at a place in LA, and that was one of the magazines. And all I remember is answering when I was going on auditions and driving a 65 Mustang and like Publicitas Globe Media, like I was the temp. And I remember they used to sell, I don't know what it is, but they would sell
advertising. Yeah,
advertising to departures and to a lot of different magazines and Travel and Leisure. And I remember sitting there, and like my love of travel is and history, like you, we can talk about that later, and acting, and just be looking through these magazines while I was trying to sneak out and go on an audition for like Carl's Jr. commercial, and being like, someday I'm going to go to this place. Someday I'm going to go to this place. And I didn't grow up in, my family in Brooklyn was so different. Like it wasn't that big European kind of family. So it was just like, I didn't have that. We went to visit our grandmas in, you know, Greece, or, you know, a lot of our friends did.
Right.
Brooklyn, where we grew up, was such a multicultural
place.
It really was, yeah.
So you're at Departures for 9 years. So that's like your second, third act at this point, maybe, because you've done like master's teaching, English kind of theater, and then you're at Departures for 9 years. And then like, how do you get to become editor in chief?
Well, I first
the longest running magazine, by the way. Congratulations.
Yes, 175 years this year.
175 years in yeah. publication. That's amazing.
It is. So I went to Town and Country first as an editor. Uh-huh. So I was in 2011, Town and Country had a new editor in chief named Jay Fielden, who I sort of knew from the business, and he had a really interesting and bold vision for what Town and Country could be. And I met with him a few times and I thought, this feels right. And, you know, I think people ask me often how I made that change, because I was at Departures for so long. I was so close to Richard David Story, who's my mentor. And really, I mean, that was a formative experience. It was the first, you know, I had interviewed for different things during that time, but it was the first interview where I thought, you know, and this is again, instinct and trusting your gut. Mm-hmm. As soon as I left that first interview with Jay, I said, this is my next job.
Isn't that amazing when that happens?
Totally. This is my next job. And, you know, I knew there would be risk because I was so comfortable at Departures and so, you know, I had so much, it was just a wonderful, wonderful place that he had let me, Richard was really wonderful about let me pursuing so many different interests. And he's really the one who put me on the jewelry course.
Oh my God, your jewelry.
Yeah. So
were you scared? Like, was that a very scary decision or that you were just like, this is,
I wasn't scared at all.
Wow.
I wasn't scared at all. You know, and I think, you know, I think, listen, there are some people who would say, you know, those 9 years, I could have moved around more and taken more chances, but I never felt that definitive, this is my next job, until I interviewed there. And so I went there and I was an editor from 2011 to 2016. And then Jay Fielden became the editor-in-chief of Esquire and they promoted me to editor-in-chief of Town & Country.
That's unbelievable. I mean, what was it like when you're like, I'm the editor in chief of the oldest running publication magazine, like ever? I just feel like that's like,
it's like, you know, I feel like
so young, you know,
I wasn't so young really. I'm one of the older editor in chiefs actually. Right. The business has changed a lot. You know, I think that, I mean, Town and Country, I've been there now since 2011. And it's just such an important part of my life. You know, it is a magazine. So many of the things that have always mattered to me, that I have always valued, have a place in that magazine. And yeah. It is a rare thing.
I've always loved that magazine. I always buy it. I've always bought it on every trip I've ever taken. And it really is one of those magazines that, like, it's just so reliable. It is what it is. It doesn't change. It doesn't sell out. It doesn't get like, okay, we're going to talk about the hottest new thing now. Do you know what I mean? It's elegance, tradition, the history, all of it.
Yeah. No. And, you know, we also, you know, I mean, it's an American treasure.
Yeah.
Town and Country. It really is. And I think that, you know, you feel almost like you're a steward of it and you're given this treasure to take care of while you are in charge of it. And, you know, it's a responsibility that I take very seriously and I love my job. I mean, you know, it gets tougher, you know, the environment is tough right now. I mean, obviously,
I survived the, you're one of the few magazines that had survived the staying in print. I mean, we have a mutual friend, Nicole Vecchiarelli, right?
Who,
I'm so fascinated by your world and always have been, but, yeah, like so many people just losing their jobs and going out of print, and then the whole digital age and like everything that happened. Like, how do you think you guys survived that huge, just, it just kind of all seemed to go away. I just remember that there was a year or two when that's all, I would visit New York. I'd go out with Nicole and some of Blaine's friends and all of them. And I'd be listening to this, like a tennis match. Cause I'm like, I know nothing. I just like pretty photos and jewelry and history and Architectural Digest. But it was just like this dog eat dog, like, you know,
there was, I remember that year where it just felt like everyone was giving up on print. I think what happened was people began to realize, and I actually think this period of the pandemic sort of has highlighted how different mediums deliver different experiences for the consumer, client, reader, whatever the sort of target audience is. And, you know, Town and Country is an experience. When you sit down with that print magazine, it is printed on beautiful paper. It is, you know, filled with beautiful images. We consider that someone is sitting down with it. And so, you know, what is that experience from start to finish? Is this page giving them calm? Is when they turn that page, are we sort of exciting them and making them laugh? Are we teaching them something? Are we making them dream? And we really think of how we order each page to create a full experience. I mean, even our headlines. I am really adamant that every single detail of every single page delivers the best possible content. You know, there's nothing that drives me crazier than a lazy headline.
That's a great quote.
Yeah.
Get that one, Dave? Dave is very interested in this. You know, he's an advertising marketing guy.
Ah, okay. Yeah,
and has his own company. And he's
you can tell when people have sort of phoned it in or given up. Yeah. And, you know, if you want someone to invest, you know, $9 and up for a print magazine and invest their time, right? They're sitting on their sofa investing their time. You need to deliver on that investment.
So do you think that just some of these other publications just didn't have like
No. I think that the industry sort of maybe gave up on itself too soon.
I think social media also, which I consider it is the best thing when you follow people like you, everybody who's listening, you need to follow Stellene's Instagram. It is so beautiful. You do the best stories. It really is beautiful and interesting. And I actually learn a lot, but I do think that the whole reality world happened, the reality shows. I mean, a lot of like the traditional things just got completely destroyed by that stuff.
Yeah. I think also, you know, there is a sense of, you know, reaction, right? Like things start changing and there is sometimes an immediate reaction where if you sort of wait and see and sort of think it through, but that's not always economically feasible. I understand that. But, you know, there are so many magazines that were closed during that time that people still are nostalgic for.
Yeah.
And you think, oh,
what do you mean, like Sassy?
Sassy.
I was in Sassy
magazine.
That was like my first modeling job was in Sassy.
Amazing. I mean, listen, people still, you know, Ruth Reichel, who had been the editor-in-chief of Gourmet, is a columnist at Town & Country. And when we post her column, people still, you know, talk about Gourmet and how much they miss it. And, you know, and I think there are a few other magazines like that. But, you know, it's, listen, I'm a magazine person. I love magazine people. And I really love making a magazine. Now I'm also, you know, I oversee the digital content also. And that's a whole other medium, you know, and why people consume digital content versus what they sit down with in a magazine, it should be different. And it is. And that's all fine.
Do you think the magazine, like when you when you come out with like your next magazine, do you think consider it like storytelling? Like the way that you come up with content, do you think of it like a storytelling thing?
Storytelling is at the heart of every single thing I do.
Right. I mean, is that your background? Like, do you think that's your drama English?
Yeah, I think it's English. I also think it's how I react to content, right? I mean, you know, it's like you have to always think, you know, if I'm asking myself this or if I'm interested in this person, I bet other people are. Let me sort of think about why and pursue that. But also it's how you, storytelling is about finding the story. It's about how you tell the story, but it's making sure you have a story. I mean, you know, another thing that Richard Story taught me this, if you don't have a headline, you don't have a story. Because if you don't know how to encapsulate what is important about that story, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm sure Dave is listening. It's the elevator pitch, right? If you can't do your elevator pitch on a story, you know, I've probably lost interest.
Dave is writing because he always writes little notes, although he's really interested in this. So, because I've only gotten one, he just wrote, I always say, if you can't tell me your idea in a single sentence, you don't have one.
Yeah. Same thing. Same thing.
You know, I'm the opposite of that. And I'm like, my mother who worked on Wall Street, and I'm, you know, guilty of this. And it's, she's always like, she would say, Bonnie, like condense, like 30 words or less. Like that's what she would tell kids when they would interview at Goldman Sachs.
Uh-huh.
Be like 30 words or less. And I'm, actors are nuts. And I'm particularly verbose, as everyone knows. And it's like, so I have such a hard time just like, so I don't even know if I could do what you guys do. Cause I'd be like, but also this. But then for some reason, when I have a script, I have an ability to be quiet and yeah, like live in those, that person's words. And I'm actually not a fan of when I work with people and they're all over the place and ad-libbing all over the place and adding stuff. And but yet in my real life, I have such a hard time.
But I mean, that's also about training, mm-hmm, isn't it? Right. I mean, like we are now trained in our industries, either formal training or training through experience. You are now trained in your art. And so you know how to do that. Whereas, you know, if you started having to write headlines all the time, you know, I mean, sometimes people on staff are like, where did that headline come from? And I say, I've been doing this for like a long time.
Yeah, it's like little jewels. Yeah, you ever wake up in the middle of the night and you're just like, I have to write this down?
Yes, but I don't generally write it down. So I mean, sometimes I'll send text messages to myself
or notes,
because I sleep with my phone near me, which I know is a bad thing. But
we all do, and it's a bad thing.
It's a bad thing. But oh yeah, and now one of my New Year's resolutions is not to send, because I also am a very early riser, and so I would sort of have these thoughts and send very early emails to editors, and I'm working on the draft folder. That's my New Year's resolution.
You so and I write get things along. He's a 5:30 a.m. 6 a.m. By the time I'm waking up, I feel like the biggest loser. He's like run 8 miles. He's pitched a few things. He's written a few things. I'm like, I'm envious of that. I want to be more of an early riser.
Well, I think, listen, someone was telling me yesterday that during this you know, pandemic period, they really have been sleeping in and how awful it is. And my feeling is whatever works for anyone to get through this time.
Yeah,
absolutely fine.
I think like, you know, again, this whole second act idea, I think I told you if you listen to the intro, it really came from, you know, in your 40s, thinking that I was going to be at a certain place, having had so many close calls, so many shows that were going to be the next big show, the next big girl, the, you know, record deals. I had two, I got dropped. And then so many just close calls. And then all of a sudden I was like in my 40s, you know, for another bad relationship, didn't end up getting married, didn't end up having kids, just everything hit rock bottom. And I was, my girlfriend said to me, she's like, Bunny, you just need to find your second act. Like, mm-hmm, it's not over. And I just was like, that is something that every single person in whatever field, like you, whether it's all failures or whether they're all successful acts. Everyone has to find their second act. So like you have to reinvent like the magazine. You have to come up with different things. It's always a second act every day.
Yes, completely. Completely. And
speaking of that, I have to get into, you know that I'm obsessed with both jewelry and history.
Yes, you told me in our DM.
You have an amazing book that just came out. And tell, I want to know how that became such a passion for you. Your the jewelry, but the historical jewelry.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm obsessed with.
Yeah. I mean, that is what made me fall in love with jewelry, was the connection between jewelry and the historical period in which it was created. And, you know, I think that I definitely grew up liking jewelry. I mean, you know, in high school, I was always like a big, you know, the big earrings, the big knockers. But I think that there was this gallery on Madison called Primavera Gallery, and it was a really amazing, amazing place with historical jewelry that, you know, now there are a lot of places that do that. It was really ahead of its time. And I was either an assistant at Vogue or in grad school. I mean, like, I had nothing to offer this woman. And her name is Audrey Friedman. She's still in business. And she really took me through pieces and explained, you know, sort of what Art Nouveau was and how, you know, why suddenly these materials were available to people in Paris, and what they might have seen sort of recently that might have inspired them. Or she showed me these amazing Cartier Sputnik pins that were, you know, directly a result of Sputnik. And you start to make these connections, right? You think of jewelry as these beautiful objects in a glass vitrine, disconnected from reality for most of us, and from anything else except the fact that they're beautiful. And once someone made that connection, sort of showed me the collision between this art and the historical forces that produced it, I was totally hooked. Because again, going back to storytelling, it gave these beautiful objects a story.
Right.
So that's where it all really got hooked.
I think I got hooked because I mean I'm a medieval history freak and that's all I read about, mostly in European history. And again, and you know, ancient Egypt. I know you've done stories on that, you know, but again, yeah, it's always the stories of what those pieces meant why people would even give jewelry. You know, it's like Anne Boleyn famously gave Henry, you know, that ship brooch. I don't know. And she had it designed and it was like a ship at sea that was rocking, and it represented like that everything, every gift represented like the story or the little puzzle rings or the
right.
And I just find that so fascinating. You can learn about a culture. I mean, even some of the stuff they find from, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ago, like monolithic stuff. It's just, it's fascinating. They usually, whether it was about a god or praying to a goddess, that's what that jewelry was about. And it's like, and the amulets and the crests and
Right. No, and also the fact that any civilization that is discovered, there's always jewelry.
Yes.
Right. And so, you know, is it frivolous? Is it about adornment? Yes, but there is obviously a human instinct for adornment. I mean, it is primal and keepsake. And it is primal. You know, so
religious jewelry was about protection jewelry was about protection and gods. And like now we wear it and it's great. But like, even now to this day, my mom just sent me the cutest thing yesterday. I mean, it was from some website. It was just all this little like evil eye, you know, like thinking of you. And it's just, it just, that's why I think I'm obsessed with jewelry. Cause it means something, you know?
Right.
I mean, everything. Dave is like, anything he ever asked me what I want, I'm like, jewelry. He's like, more jewelry? I'm like, you can't ever have enough jewelry. Like, I don't think you can.
Well, thank God for people like you. No, it's, you know, listen, it means something to you personally, right? It has that. I mean, the dimensions of jewelry also fascinate me, because it has a place in some of the most important moments of your life. I mean, think about your engagement. It is sealed with a piece of jewelry. And then it also, when discovered, can tell you by the stones that are used or the motifs that is used, you know, you can date jewelry and place it in a historical period. And that to me gives it a place in history as much as anything else.
Is that the most interesting part of jewelry to you? Is that aspect of it? Like the yes. storytelling? So it's it all goes back to storytelling for you.
Storytelling. And listen, sometimes, you know, as I've gotten to know jewelers, their stories too make it, right? So it's, you know, knowing who created something is as important as when it was created.
Mm, and the artistry of it.
The artistry of it. And it's such an intimate art, right? I mean, jewelers take their hands, put them on the stone, they carve the gold, you know, and then you wear it on your hand, right? It is such a very direct link between creator and, you know, and the piece of art, and then the wearer. It, you know, someone, this amazing French jeweler, Marie-Hélène de Taillac, told me that if a woman in or a person in her workshop was in a bad mood, she would send them home. She wouldn't let them work on the jewelry because their bad mood would sort of seep into the stones. So and
you've seen the crown jewels, obviously.
Yes. Yes.
And all that stuff, I'm fascinated too. I mean, there was a part of history where jewelry was commerce.
Yeah.
You know, jewelry was, you know, dowries. Jewelry was money. I mean, it was like, you'll get these pearls and Queen Elizabeth's pearls in exchange for, I mean, it's
right.
It's fascinating. I know. I think of it like you. I don't know if everyone does, but I love your stories so much, because you talk about, you know, whether it's Wallace Simpson or like whenever you're talking about the hearse, like you give the store. And I'm always, when I look at your Instagram and the magazine, I'm like, are people understanding like how cool this is? And like, what was going on in this period in history when Diana got that ring and blah, 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 you know? And I don't know. I have such a similar passion to it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting to think about, you know, I think this season of The Crown, you really saw sort of the role jewelry played, and it was a real plot point.
That was when she picked out her ring.
When she picked out her ring, or the, you know, the bracelet that she discovers Charles is making for Camilla. You know, I mean, there's lots of, you know, jewelry sort of moves the plot a lot this season.
I just love that you're, because you're a historian and you love history like me. And I love that with you, it's so much more than the jewelry and the, you know, whether it's fancy or not. Like, that's so not how you, you know, that's not your thing. It's just, it's more about what it's about, what it represents. And again, the storytelling, that's why I love the way you do your stories on Instagram.
Oh, thank you. I love stories. It's my favorite part of Instagram.
So is this like your act? What do you, this is, well, 15th act is the books, is the writing of jewelry and the you know, telling these stories and doing more books?
I love writing books. I did an interview for a magazine about time management, how I wrote the book while, you know, editing the magazine. And now I'm also the editorial director of Elle Decor too. So I have sort of, you know, and the pace of writing a book is so different than what I do at the magazine that it feels almost like this sort of cocoon I can go into when I am writing a book. You know, it means sort of like a year of, I mean, there's no weekends, no vacations, but there's a sort of quiet to writing a book that writing for magazines has a much more sort of like, you know, it's more sort of staccato, like you're like boom, 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 boom. So I do love the experience. I mean, my first book came out, I guess, about 4 years ago, and then this book just came out. So I think that's a pretty good pace. So I'd love to do another one And this book
tell everybody what the book is called, because I got it on Amazon.
It's called Jewels That Made History. Seriously? And it's very sort of cleverly sized. I worked with Rizzoli again, and Caitlin LaFell, who was my editor on the first book, was my editor on this book, and a man named Matt Berman designed it, who had been the creative director of George magazine. So that's how I first knew him, because we worked at that company for a little bit. I said I wanted to feel like a digest. Right, a sort of glossary, but nothing boring. I don't want it to feel like a dictionary, but I want it to feel like something you can sort of reference. And sort of they both came up with this very clever size. So sometimes people order it and then are surprised that it's not Reader's Digest size. It's not that small, but it is. You can't see me, so I forgot I'm on a podcast.
It's okay. Maybe we'll show this part, but it is stunning. Okay. It's beautiful.
Thank you very much. I loved writing it, and I'm glad people seem to be enjoying it. So that makes me really happy.
I'm so happy to talk to you, and I really am. I can't believe we went to the same high school either. Like that really, that just trips me out. A lot of us did pretty well, you know?
Yeah. Listen, it was, you know, for me, I had a wonderful experience there. And I think in many ways, if I looked at the timeline of where I am now, a lot of that started at Poly. A lot of it was, as we said before, because there were a few people there that really said, you can do this. And
there were some really great teachers there. And my love of history started in high school. But definitely being a Brooklyn girl, come on, you love a jewelry, starts very young, because like it was all about like the door knockers and then the Tiffany bean and then the Tiffany heart and then the silver bracelets. We all had to have the Tiffany.
Yeah.
And all I ever wanted was the Cartier ring, which I ended up buying myself. My first job, I was like,
amazing. I love that.
First job, I was like, I am buying that Trinity ring for myself. But all of that came from I think the 80s and 90s and being in Brooklyn.
Yeah, or a nameplate. I mean, I feel like the time you were, you know, like it might have sort of phased out, but when I was like a freshman, sophomore, having a nameplate was really, and you know, of course, my name, I had to get a custom nameplate.
I can't see you with a Stellene nameplate. You're way too elegant.
I had one, believe me, I had one.
Well, I told you that this is an extract, but I think I said in one of our DMs that my dream is to do a historical jewelry line, you know, I'm so fascinated. That's why I love your book so much. And I just, that's another act that I have in me sometime.
Yeah.
Affordable, you know, cause not everyone can afford to get the Cartier stuff and all the you know, right. Dave, you're going to get me all that rich stuff, historical jewelry, right? So I'm going to ask you I usually ask people like a bunch of questions at the end.
Sure.
You can answer them or you can just be like, pass.
Okay.
I had like one person that was like offended that I asked some political stuff. So I don't know. Okay. So if you could have one piece of jewelry that you have seen and held in your hands and you could have it and someone would give it to you. I know that's a very hard question.
Yeah, I know what it is.
Oh, what is it?
It's the piece that got away. So there is a jeweler named Suzanne Belperron that was one of the most daring jewelers, I would say ever, and one of the very few female jewelers of the sort of 20s, 30s, 40s. And I had once seen and tried on this amazing white agate spinel ring, and it fit me. And a lot of her original stuff is very small.
Yeah, they were tiny.
They were tiny. And I think it was like $8,000. And I was like, forget it. I mean, you know, whatever. Now the market for her pieces, that ring probably would be about $40,000.
Oh.
So it's the one that got away. Also, I feel her imagination was just incredible, but also her character was so incredible. She had a partner who was Jewish, and he you know, was sent to the camps and gave her the business, and she kept it running while he was at the camps. He died. He was killed in the camps, and his son somehow made it back to Paris, and you sort of, you know, they met, and he said, you know, thank you so much for keeping this and keeping, you know, Hertz-Belperron going. And she said, you know, well, it's both of ours. And she then, they became partners. So she just is, I mean, she was just, in a word, fierce in every way. So fierce. Yeah, she was fierce.
Okay. What is something that you really, really want to do that you have not done yet? Because you've done a lot.
I would like to learn to drive.
What?
You
don't know how to drive?
I had a license briefly, very briefly. And I would like to, not that I would probably drive. I'm a sort of, you know, very proud New Yorker. And part of me loves that I don't drive, because as soon as I tell people I don't drive, they're like, oh, obviously you're from New York. So I do love that. But, you know, I think that there is a sort of, you know, there's a certain independence that comes.
Just a little bit. I mean, maybe driving. A tiny bit of independence where you don't need to take the jitney or get a ride, or like you could just get in your car. I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. LA life, as you know, forget it. I mean,
I know. I mean, so I love LA so much, and I used to come out there all the time. And it was, you know, when Uber was introduced in LA, it like changed my life.
Yeah.
Because I was either dependent on friends, or I would try and get cabs in LA, which was really hard. And so Uber changed my life, but still I should learn to drive.
You had to do it though in poly. Like we all, I mean, at one
point.
Well,
I took driver's ed, but the driver's ed teacher, it's one of my ongoing skits that I like to do, because people love a Bay Ridge story. Yeah. I'm sure you know that, right? They love to hear about Bay Ridge.
They love Brooklyn. Anything.
They love Brooklyn. But I always say Bay Ridge is a certain kind of Brooklyn. Like it is true blue Brooklyn. Yeah. And it's old school Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And so we had a driver's ed guy, and all he wanted us to learn how to do was palm the wheel. So I was like, what is going on here?
Was he like in an IROC?
He would be like, look, I don't even have to look. I'm at 12 o'clock. I'm at 3 o'clock. And that's all he wanted, to show us how to palm the wheel.
Oh my God.
And it's one of my like classic, one of the classic Bay Ridge stories in my itinerary.
I'll tell you, I dated a guy that did not know how to drive in the older years of my life. And when a man doesn't know how to drive, it's not as cute. I'm just going to say that. When you're living in Los Angeles and a man doesn't drive, it's not good. I mean, you can't, what are you going to do? You can't, I mean, there's no other way. There's no public transit.
No.
Second, I go to New York. Listen,
even as, you know, I travel a lot. I travel a lot on my own, and it's probably time, but, you know.
But you have a driver, right? For the work?
No. No. I mean, for work, I can walk to work, which is amazing. And you know, I mean, it's New York. I either walk every place, which I love. I'm a big, big walker, and or I, you know, take a cab.
You're making me so nostalgic. When I was home doing Blue Bloods, I was so happy, and Dave came with me, and it was his first time in Brooklyn, and we didn't even get to go to Bay Ridge and Brooklyn Heights, you know, where I grew up, because there was no time, but I just must have said every 5 seconds, like, don't you love it here? Wouldn't you rather live it here? Wouldn't you rather live here? And he was like, yeah, I love it. It's great. And he, you know, he runs, he's a runner. So he's been going to New York way for years without me for clients and, you know, advertising stuff. But I just, when I get there, it's just the feeling of the freedom of going yeah. outside, walking or jumping in the, on the subway or cat. There is nothing like it out here in LA. Yeah. You yeah. are trapped here to go to like shopping. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. What do you think Town and Country is going to look like 10 years from now? And are you still going to be there?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, that's not totally my decision. I will be sort of emotionally and spiritually with Town and Country forever. I mean, I really think it is also, I mean, the editors and the staff of Town and Country are, you know, it's a real crew. And we have also, you know, lots of contributors and people that we feature that have become great friends. So it is, it's always going to be a part of my life, I hope. And I think, you know, what's amazing is after 175 years, it does look different, but you'd still recognize it as Town and Country no matter what year. And I think that's sort of the secret to it. I mean, in 1846, these two young guys decided to create this magazine, and their mission, we have the like original editor's letter in the office. And their mission was to instruct, refine, and amuse. Mm. And when we are putting the issue together, like I just got the page plan for the March issue. So it's sort of the whole magazine in like mini tiles. And, you know, I look at it and think, am I teaching our readers something? Am I sort of showing them the best of what's out there? And am I making them laugh a little bit? Am I sort of raising their eyebrow a little bit? So that continues. Mm-hmm. And I think that really it has always, you always see that, you know, I mean, we have this amazing archive room in the office, and you could go in there and look at a Town and Country from 1901. You could look at, you know, a Town and Country from 1963, 1973,
it's,
you know,
like Brooks
Brothers. Yeah. And, you know, obviously the people change, you know, who we're covering, and Town and Country, you know, those principles do not mean that it's stuck in time. They're a guide, but it continues to evolve and grow, and I hope just get better.
Okay. Here's a juicy question. You don't have to give me a name, but have you ever been pitched somebody for the cover that you have just been without, like, absolutely not? Like, I don't care who, how big she is.
I think it's clear sort of, you know, there has to be some, I think the, you know, what makes a great cover is like a constant topic of conversation, especially now as, you know, like the newsstand is not as strong, obviously, for anybody. And the pandemic has just, you know, really sort of rushed that. So for me, the cover subject has to make sense as a Town and Country cover subject, or there's, you know, when someone goes to buy it, there's sort of a disconnect, you know, and same thing, or if our subscriber is receiving it in their home, you know, and it doesn't make sense as a Town and Country cover, then we're not doing our job.
That's very, very kind, diplomatic, wonderfully elegant answer to me trying to get some juice. I'm like, what chick would I not put on the cover? Let me start. Okay. How about this? What do you think was, cause I know you're so great also following you during the award seasons and all the, you know, all your top picks. Like what do you think was like one of the worst faux pas jewelry moments? And I want to know if you agree with me about one. I have one.
Well, my biggest faux pas is when people don't wear jewelry.
you're not into that, like no jewelry look?
No, I'm not. Oh, also because, you know, when you're on the red carpet, and I would like to see more imaginative jewelry. You know, I think I always talk, I mean, Eva Mendez one year wore this turquoise and diamond Van Cleef, like big necklace. Mm-hmm. And I always post it, like the Golden Globes, I always post it.
I always see you post it.
It is so gorgeous. And it was such a risk. I think Rachel Zoe styled her, and it was a risk because no one was wearing jewelry then. It was like all sort of diamond studs. Yeah.
I love the look. I you know, the when Diana wore the choker as a headband.
Yes. Yeah.
Like someday when I get to the
club, exactly.
I will be calling you and you will help me.
Better.
You will help me borrow something. But I thought that was so fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like people that do that, like, and I remember Michelle Williams when she was with Heath Ledger, that yellow dress and you know, putting the brooch in the hair, that kind of thing.
Right. Right. Cameron Diaz once wore this beautiful diamond barrette when she was wearing this beautiful Chloe outfit and she had like a very short bob and just a diamond barrette in her hair. Or, she too, one year, I miss her on the red carpet very much. Actually,
I miss her too. I think I was saying today that she really had like the elegance mixed with the rock star style.
And I watched Being John Malkovich a few weeks ago. She was amazing. And that movie is brilliant. But she once wore this like fuchsia strapless gown and really bold turquoise jewelry.
I love that. The mix and match. That,
right. Or Cate Blanchett, I think also really, you know, she has this Jean-Paul Gaultier sort of black dress with all this sort of vintage Indian jewelry sort of all down her back. You know, I mean, my feeling is when you are going to be on a red carpet, you have access to everything.
Right.
Go for it, have fun with it. And, you know,
dream for so long, like not only just to get to do the work. I mean, of course I want to do the work, but like getting to do the jewelry thing, I would be like more. I remember Kate Hudson said more is more like, and I'm like that sometimes. I mean, I'm covered like, you know, layer and layering. And I'm like, I mean, what else am I going to do? I mean, like, it's not like I'm going out. I mean, I just want to put more on, you know? Yeah.
No. Well, when that happens, you call me and we'll also get Dave some jewelry because the other thing that I have loved over the last, I would say year or two is men on the red carpet wearing jewelry.
You did a whole thing on that.
We did. And we had amazing actors, sort of in jewelry and artists. And the last Oscars before shutdown. So like that February where we were all still so like naive about what was to come. There was not a man on the red carpet without some jewelry, like a lapel pin or a necklace. And that really sort of meant a lot to me.
Well, as long as you style it, I will allow it.
Absolutely. I can't wait to style you for this.
If he brings out his old 1980s kind of, you were never into that stuff, but the hard rocker, you know, he's a hard rock guy. No, it's got to be done right. And the last question is, when I get my big job, will you please have me in the magazine where I can do a historical jewelry thing?
I would love that. Well, I will tell you that you being on Blue Bloods and the fact that I know you has like made a huge impression on my mother. She loves Blue Bloods so much. And she thinks they should bring your character back. And that storyline is so great.
It is great. I thought for sure. Is your mom, does she have I have a Greek accent?
No, not at all. My mother was born in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So she's of Greek descent. My father was born in Greece. No, my mother has a big Brooklyn accent.
Well, then I'm saying she talks like, like my mother. Like, it's like, why are you not on the show? I don't understand. Actually, Dave said to me the other day, what's going on? Your accent has come out. Like, it just, like, it comes and goes. But lately, it's just been like talking like this again. But yeah, it's a great character. Listen, I'm so lucky to have worked at all. But that show is crazy. I mean, longest running show now, other than you.
I know.
I'm so glad I got to talk to you
too. So get on that too.
I will get on that, and I will get on something where I can you can do a historic, drape me in whatever. Honestly, it's and when I come to New York, I would love to come see the archives. I would love to visit.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully,
and get together again because last time you invited me and I couldn't make it, but
Well, hopefully soon we'll be back in the office. And
yes.
But you know, New York is trying. There are amazing sort of outdoor restaurant setups, and
I know we loved it when I was there. When it, you know, it's, I don't know what they're doing here. I really don't. I mean, businesses are going under left and right around this neighborhood, so it's really sad. But hopefully, everyone's next act. I mean, look, we have a new president.
Yeah. No, right? I think speaking of second acts, I think both our cities hopefully are gearing up for theirs. Yeah. And all we can all do is support and, you know, and enjoy, you know, we both live in amazing, amazing American cities. So
we do.
Yeah. So
thank you for talking to me. You're so glamorous and fabulous. And I love following you. Everybody, please follow your Instagram is unbelievable. Like it's, I love it. It's so beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great.
Hollandes.
Great to see you. Bobby Somerville. Great to see you too. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
I love that woman. She is so accomplished and so elegant, and she's done so many things with her life. And definition of second act, I mean, go from being a public high school teacher to editor-in-chief of Town and Country magazine and a book author and growing up in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. What's up, Brooklyn? All my peeps, I hope you're listening. I hope you downloaded and subscribed, especially you Poly Prep alumni. But I'm so proud of her. You have to buy her book. Like I said, it's on Amazon. It's called Jewels That Made History, 101 Stones, Myths, and Legends. It's stunning. It's absolutely beautiful. I could have talked about the historical jewelry thing the entire time. If anybody knows me, that two are my biggest passions are those things. I'm probably going to try to get some history people on here soon and talk more about history. So hopefully your ears don't bleed when I do that, like my friends do. Anyway, follow her on Instagram, Stellene Volandes, just her name, Volandes. I love her. She's awesome. Thank you guys for listening. And like I said, please follow the new Instagram account because those bastards deleted my old one. I have no idea why. It just disappeared one day. So now we have to do all the work all over again. Thanks, Dave, for doing all that work. And it is second_act_podcast on Instagram. And I really look forward to hearing from you guys. I'm so happy to be back. And I have a lot of stories about what went down, and we'll get into that and how I am living my second act again and again and again and again. And ask me a question on Instagram. So I want to have a question and answer session in the pod session. I just flipped my words. I want to have a question and answer session. And hear from you guys and answer questions. And I'll have a podcast soon where I'm going to talk only about me and my second act and my third and fourth and fifth act. So that should be interesting. And I'm wishing you all lots of love and happy new year. And I hope everybody is healthy and safe and stay healthy and wear a mask. And let's do this, 2021. Let's do this. Okay, lots of love.